This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Our top story, President Donald Trump says he has total confidence in Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The president is bothering to tell you that because his attorney general might be caught up in the investigation into Russian election meddling. The Washington Post broke this story. Their political reporter will join us live in about 5 minutes. Hope you can stay tuned. Last year, Seattle was called a success story for federal oversight of police. In fact, the U.S. Attorney General at that time, Loretta Lynch, praised the Seattle Police Department's new policies for dealing with people in crisis and for reducing the use of force. Well, now the Trump administration says it's going to back away from that oversight role of police forces. KUOW's Amy Radel reports that people involved in Seattle's consent decree have mixed feelings on this new direction.
The new Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, says the U.S. Justice Department will pull back from investigating police practices across the country. He suggested that federal scrutiny had undermined respect for police. Jenny Durkin is the former U.S. Attorney for Western Washington and helped negotiate the consent decree with the Seattle Police Department. She predicts that not only will the DOJ not open new investigations, but existing agreements will be dissolved.
Police departments and cities will be able to approach the Department of Justice and ask that a monitoring agreement be terminated and some other less formal agreement be implemented. And I think that will happen in a lot of jurisdictions.
Durkin says withdrawing from pending consent decrees would hurt policing, send the wrong message to communities, and could result in more public protests over police shootings. But she says departments like SPD have developed better practices as a result of their consent decrees. Now the DOJ can share those with other cities on a voluntary basis.
So if they now have a better way to use that best available policies, procedure, and training and get them out to departments and not have to do a monitoring agreement, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
As far as undermining respect for police, Durkin says these reforms in use of force were initiated to help police as well as the public.
The use of force, particularly deadly force, is a very traumatic thing for a police officer, too. And we want to reduce the number of those situations to the minimal amount possible. And the way you do that is with best training, best policy, best tools, best resources.
Durkin predicted that the Seattle Police Department will be relatively unaffected by the new direction at the DOJ. It's up to U.S. District Judge James Robart, who's overseeing the process. Brian Maxey is the chief operating officer for the Seattle Police Department. He says after 5 years, Seattle is in the home stretch on meeting the goals of its consent decree, so no big changes are necessary. He says initially the DOJ's findings on excessive use of force at SPD came as a shock, but he says going through this process ultimately benefited the department.
I do not think this process has been easy for the police officers. I think there's been a lot of criticism, some of which is warranted, some of which has not. It certainly has had an impact on morale, but overall I think we're seeing a pretty large recovery in that morale. And I think we're pretty optimistic about the direction of the police department.
Maxey says he'd like to think the department could have resolved the concerns collaboratively without a consent decree. But at this point, there's a sense of accomplishment.
It's real. It's measurably real. We actually have had tangible change in our department. And I think we're one of the few departments that can actually point to that change, show it statistically. And I think at the city level, we're finally actually beginning to celebrate some of those successes.
Maxey says the latest SPD statistics show extremely low rates of use of force generally and toward people in crisis. And he says while the DOJ investigations highlighted the need to address these issues, those concerns have now been embraced by police chiefs around the country. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
So there's Attorney General Jeff Sessions' new take on police oversight. Today, Sessions has some other things on his mind. There is a gathering storm around him, is how the Washington Post put it. The Post broke the story that Attorney General Sessions spoke twice with the Russian ambassador during the presidential campaign, which sounds fishy because Sessions claimed under oath that he didn't have contact with Russian officials. Washington Post political reporter Dave Weigel joins us live. Dave, welcome back to KUOW. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
What is the worst thing the Attorney General has done here?
At worst, the way that Al Franken, who's the senator, kind of prompted this exchange, has put it, at worst, he might have misled the Congress under oath about the contact he had with Russian diplomats right before the end of the campaign in September. He said he didn't have any, and the strange thing about the exchange was that Franken didn't ask explicitly if he had talked to him. Sessions brought it up himself, and this is also, I would point out, different than what Sessions said in written testimony. So that, the worst here is that he plagiarized, and that's the Democrats going the furthest are saying here it's pretty cut and dry that he plagiarized. I'd say the most moderate Democrats are saying at the very least he should recuse himself from the investigations they want into Russia.
Isn't it possible that Sessions was just saying he didn't talk to Russians in his role as a Trump campaign advisor, but as a senator, member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he did?
Except that the timeline doesn't make a lot of sense here because our reporting suggests that it was more in the context of what was happening in the campaign. It was September when Congress is basically done for the year. Congress is kind of unfortunately, but none of people know, doesn't really do a lot of work in the last few months of presidential election. And again, he brought it up himself. He brought it up during a period where Democrats were raising questions even almost not quite to the volume they are now about whether Russians intervened to help Trump win the election. So the hair splitting here, I think, is a little bit dangerous, and that's why you've seen a lot of Republicans already come out and say, well, let's nip this in the bud by having Sessions recuse himself from anything about any investigation into Russia. And they can do that because they're already trying to find ways, led by Jason Chaffetz and Devin Nunes, trying to find ways to have broad Russia election interference probes that they don't think are as targeted as what Democrats want.
So if the Attorney General recuses himself from the FBI's investigation of Russian election meddling, why would that be a big deal? What's at stake there?
A lot is at stake, and Democrats aren't under the impression that they will bring down this presidency just for these investigations. It is more of a ongoing nagging question that they think reveals that the president doesn't have a lot of legitimacy, and that undermines every act he takes. I'd say the strategy here is a little bit complicated because there's a division among Democrats of whether they should be focusing on this as much as they are focusing on Trump's policies. It was not the Democrats who dug this up. It was Washington Post reporters, and it's this greater community in D.C. and the intelligence community and the diplomatic community that are aware of this and are blowing whistles about it. It's really not a political question. It becomes a political question when senators learn about it, but it begins as something else.
Well, President Trump said today he wasn't aware that Sessions had spoken to the Russian ambassador, but he has total confidence in Sessions. I think many listeners are asking that bigger question. Is President Trump in big trouble? What do you think?
It depends how you define it, because right now he has a Republican Congress that is not interested in setting up a special prosecutor and any investigation even comparable to the Benghazi Committee, which as Republicans admitted kind of and then backed down from, which did hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign for president. There's not the effort by Republicans to do that to their president right now. There are Republicans like Lindsey Graham open to doing that, and you wonder if there are people who Trump has undermined and refused to work with and made fun of that are looking for an opportunity at some point to legitimize one of these investigations. But really, among Republicans, this is not seen as a real threat unless Democrats win one of the houses of Congress in 2018 and open the probes that they're trying to open. That's what Republicans did after a few years after they took control of Congress. In talking to Republicans, though, they're not blasé about this. They're trying to find a version of this story, much as Democrats often did with Hillary Clinton, in which Sessions acted just normally and forgot about something and was making no malicious moves. They're trying to find a way around that, but they're not ruling out one day investigating this. I mean, they realize that this is toxic and it's not going away after the campaign as they might have thought.
Okay, so then what happens next in this Russia session story?
Well, more pressure by Democrats to launch an official probe through Congress, create a special prosecutor. Again, not much they can do, but they're pretty pleased, frankly, with how much the focus on this has hurt the administration. I mean, in the first month of his presidency, the president lost his national security advisor because of campaign contacts. And it's kind of only natural for any political party, if they see something weaken a president why not worry it again? Why not continue to focus on that connection? I'd also say this is not insincere. I hope I'm not giving the impression that they're looking for a political strategy. There is a real outrage among Democrats. It's more sincere than you find in a lot of political activity. That this was this is an election that was won by somebody who lost the popular vote and repeatedly got aid from hackers stealing the information of their campaign, and so there is a relish in finding out this information that I think is more emotional than what you often get from parties that lost. And there have been parties that lost elections and threw up roadblocks before, but there's not the same feeling of, I wouldn't say despair, of something stolen that there is with Democrats right now, and that's why the Russia thing resonates for them.
We're talking about the substance and the relish involved in this Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Russia election meddling all getting twisted up, and we're talking about it with Washington Post political reporter Dave Weigel, who has one of the Twitter feeds that I highly recommend, informative, entertaining, and it's just always good to talk with you. I want to ask you something else, Dave. Another top Republican is accusing his party of hiding their plans to replace the Affordable Care Act. Would you tell us what's going on there?
That's in some ways more complicated than this, in some ways pretty simple. So the House Republicans have been workshopping a replacement of the ACA that they can pass right after they repeal it through the reconciliation process. This is the way that they only need 51 votes to do something. Rand Paul is more than any Republican. I mean, he's kind of had trouble finding other Republicans who will go with him on this. Just ruled out voting for that, and today went to the room where Republicans were, members of the committee that's drafting this, were talking, were looking at what might be in the legislation. He went to it kind of theatrically demanding that he see a copy of it. There's not really a copy to see, but what he was trying to do is emphasize that Republicans are putting together a piece of legislation that they're going to drop, they hope next week, without a lot of time for the public to investigate it. And what he's doing there is exploiting the rhetoric Republicans used for years on the Affordable Care Act, which was complaining that anyone who lived through in this country in that process complained that what seemed like a very long, drawn-out process, lots of public hearings, was in fact something done in a back room with the public unable to see the product.
Right.
Paul, who does not want anything less than a full repeal of Obamacare, is kind of willing to expose and hurt this process by kind of pointing out the hypocrisy. I mean, that's what he's trying to do. The Republican leadership really resented that he did this. There's not much they can do as a way of revenge. The guy just won a 6-year term.
Fissures among in the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., and we'll keep following it. That's Washington Post political reporter Dave Weigel. Pleasure to talk to you, Dave. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record. More to come. What happened with that little Amazon cloud crash and the hazard of old abandoned coal mine tunnels and more coming up. At KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke, giving you a little news update now. Remember earlier this week when the internet broke a little bit? The GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop told us that it was servers at Amazon, downed servers, that made a lot of websites slow down or quit working.
There's a service that Amazon runs called the Simple Storage Service. They call it S3 in the biz. And essentially, that is what went down for what, as of now, are unexplained reasons.
Ah, but those reasons are unexplained no more. Here's what happened. A member of Amazon's S3 team, as you just heard, that's what they call it in the biz, that Amazon team member was working on an issue in the billing system, and the member typed the wrong command. And instead of removing a small number of servers, it set in motion a chain of events that brought down the system. So that was it. A human typo broke the internet this week. Amazon apologized and says they will learn from this. Now, on to more news at KUOW Seattle now. President Trump's joint address to Congress on Tuesday. He called for a so-called merit-based system for immigration, different from what we have now, merit-based.
We will have so many more benefits. It will save countless dollars, raise workers' wages, and help struggling families, including immigrant families, enter the middle class.
How could a merit-based system of immigration affect the Puget Sound area? KUOW's Kim Malcolm asked reporter Daryl Lind, who covers immigration for Vox, and Lind said the term merit-based is political code for talking about who gets to legally immigrate to the U.S.
Instead of the system we currently have in the U.S., where there are multiple different paths by which an immigrant can come here, a merit-based immigration system would kind of streamline that process so that the U.S. was deliberately selecting immigrants who had high skills, who were more educated, and who theoretically were more likely to contribute to the U.S. economy.
Here in Seattle, as you know, we have a large tech community. Thousands of H-1B visa holders live and work here. How could a merit-based system affect the city of Seattle and cities like ours?
Well, it really depends. Some of the people who support merit-based immigration want, their end goal is to allow more high-skilled immigrants to come to the U.S. They want more people like the ones who are living in Seattle to be able to, you know, be here and contribute to the economy. For others, their concern isn't more high-skilled immigrants so much as it is fewer low-skilled immigrants. So in that circle, you know, if we're putting together a merit-based system that is more restrictionist in nature, communities like Seattle don't change so much, but communities that bring in a lot of, you know, where a lot of people are immigrating to be close to family members or coming for lower, you know, for lower skill, lower income jobs are going to suffer a great deal.
Dara, you mentioned some of the people in Trump's inner circle are skeptical of high-skilled immigrants. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, this is why the fact that merit-based immigration can often just be code for fewer low-skilled immigrants is relevant, because it's totally possible that instead of cutting immigration across the board as they might ideally like, this is the kind of compromise position the Trump administration is staking out, that they're going to keep the same number of high-skilled immigrants, reduce low-skilled immigration, and call it a merit-based system. But this is where the really ethno-nationalism of Steve Bannon becomes very relevant, because he appears to be skeptical that certain kinds of immigrants from, say, Asia or the Muslim world can assimilate to the U.S. at all, and appears to be very concerned that if those people come and settle here, even if they're settling for good, even if they're very skilled, that they're going to take American jobs. So what kind of merit-based system the Trump administration is really talking about really depends on how much Steve Bannon's anxiety about high-skilled permanent immigration shapes the proposal that they end up coming up with or that they end up supporting in Congress.
As someone who covers immigration day in and day out, where do you think this idea of merit-based immigration could go under this administration and with the input of Congress?
It's extremely difficult to get anything through Congress right now, and in particular an immigration bill. And unlike some things that President Trump has already done on immigration enforcement, where the president has a great deal of, you know, authority and a lot of leeway, changes to the legal immigration system, especially changes that are this big, absolutely would have to go through Congress and be, you know, designed in a bill and debated and passed. So it's hard to see anything really gaining traction. There have been proposals in the past that haven't gotten very far because Democrats are wary about reducing family-based immigration, especially if it's not coming with something for unauthorized immigrants who are already here. So it's hard to imagine that a proposal to totally reform the legal immigration system wouldn't get caught up in the debates that are already happening over border security and over unauthorized immigrants. This is kind of why in the past members of Congress have tried to tackle this as, you know, a comprehensive all-at-once solution, because once you try to pull any piece out, there's always some group of members of Congress who doesn't want to play.
Reporter Dara Lind covers immigration for Vox. You will get more stories about immigration and other ways President Trump's policies are affecting people in our region when you visit KUOW.org. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you're here for this next story. Lakeview Cemetery sits on a grassy slope in Seattle's Capitol Hill. At Lakeview, there are two graves that matter to Linda Dahlstrom Anderson. One is the grave of film and martial arts star Bruce Lee, but the other is the grave of her 7-month-old son, Phoenix.
Phoenix had been a super healthy little boy. He was our first child, and he was this beautiful, vibrant, you know, sweet, smart, bouncy little guy. And the morning of July 7th, we woke up really early. He was, you know, in this little co-sleeper next to me, and I heard this kind of little moaning sound almost, and it alarmed me. I checked his temperature, and he had a fever of about 102, which isn't crazy for a baby, but he'd never been sick before. And so my husband, Mike, and I just, we got worried, and it was too early for the pediatrician to be open. And so we took him to the emergency room, and they checked him out and diagnosed him as having the flu. And then we went back home, and he still just didn't seem right. He just, it's like all those kind of motherly instincts going off. And so a few hours later, we just, by then the pediatrician was open. And so we just took him back to the pediatrician's office. And I felt a little silly because we had just been at the hospital. But while we were in the pediatrician's office, he developed this rash that was a telltale sign for bacterial meningitis. And so from that point, we went back to the hospital, and he died that evening, and it was within 12 hours of his first symptom.
What can you say?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot. And we were able to be with him the whole time, which I'm really grateful for. You know, his, I mean, you know from radio the importance of the human voice, and my voice was the last thing he heard, I think, my husband's voice. We were able to be with him. We sang to him. We, you know, it was this big act of will to keep it together so that I could be sounding calm and loving for him as he went. And there was a moment where the doctors were doing CPR on him, and I knew he probably wasn't going to make it at that point. But you want to surround your children in love all of the time. All the moments of their life, and in my case, all the moments of his death. So we were with him through the end, and then he died that evening.
We're so sorry about that.
Thank you, Bill.
Why did you and your husband decide to bury Phoenix at Lakeview Cemetery in Seattle?
It's this wonderful historic cemetery, and you probably know it's right next to Volunteer Park, where there's festivals and music that happens. And Lakeview is this, it's a vibrant cemetery. That's probably a weird word for a cemetery, but it's kind of teeming with life, where people go running through there and walks through there. And it's beautiful. And it's where a lot of historic graves are. And a lot of the founders of Seattle are buried there. And there's these beautiful, beautiful monuments. And so, and I had been there, in fact, walking through it. And years ago, I had been there because Bruce Lee is buried there. And I had walked through kind of as a tourist in my own town and visited that grave and walked around. So when Phoenix died, it's like, it's hard to think clearly at all about anything, but we wanted him to be somewhere, first of all, that was somewhat close to where we lived, but also that had a nice feel to it. And so that's why we picked that spot.
When was the first time someone at Lakeview, at the cemetery, asked you for directions to Bruce Lee's grave?
It was just a few days after Phoenix died, and Mike and I, my husband and I, were at the cemetery with the cemetery director and a group of our friends and family. And I remember the cemetery director had this map out, and he was standing there with this map pointing to us the different plots that were available. And I remember my legs were shaking so hard that I felt like I was about to fall. And my best friend, Jen, knelt down and steadied my legs so that I could stand. It was important to me to just be able to stand while I took care of picking a place for Phoenix to be buried. And so all this is going on, and all of a sudden I hear this voice, this woman walks up to our group, excuse me. And she says to us, can you tell me where Bruce Lee is buried? And, you know, I just was stunned, and, you know, we're all kind of a mess. And I remember just whirling on her and saying, we are picking out our son's grave. And she kind of recoiled, and she started kind of backing off. And then I had this moment of sort of reconnecting with who I am as a person in life, which is fairly polite. and I said to my friend, go tell her it's just over the hill, back that way. And so she did. And that was the first time, first of many.
How often did that happen?
All the time. All the time. That first summer, we were out there a lot, and it was surprisingly common. Phoenix is buried down the other side of a hill from Bruce Lee, so he's near. He's not right there, but he's near. And so basically, if you overshoot Bruce Lee's grave, you get to Phoenix's grave. And so, you know, my husband and I would be sitting there at his grave or watering flowers or things like that. And we would get asked pretty commonly, and still to this day, when I'm out there, it's about every maybe third or fourth time I'm out there when I get asked.
And what are you thinking when that person asks you, where's Bruce Lee's grave?
Well, there's this whole evolution in my thinking. At first, we'd be sitting at Phoenix's grave in those early days of grief and just a mess, sometimes laying on his grave sobbing, and you'd hear somebody come up and kind of steel yourself for the question. And sometimes I would just say, I don't know, or I would just say, I'm at my son's grave, hoping that they would get it. Mike would get irritated and he would say, you know, this is a working cemetery. This is, there are actually people here grieving. You know, could we please have privacy? And then sometimes if I was in the right mood, I would tell people, you know, just back that way over the hill, you're close. And then they would, you know, head off that way.
You had a moment, Linda, that seemed to change the way you feel about that tourist in a cemetery. What happened?
I went to the cemetery one day and you know, there were little toys that friends had brought on Phoenix's grave and flowers that we'd left and things like that. But then I saw something different. It was two photos of children, little school photos, little kind of wallet size, laying there on top of his grave. And there was a piece of paper next to it. And so I sat down and I looked at the pictures and I opened the paper. And it started out, I'm in town for business, said the guy's name. I'm in town for business. And I came to the cemetery to visit Bruce Lee's grave, and I got lost. And instead, I found Phoenix's grave. And I want you to know that I sat down with him, and I sang him lullabies, and I told him stories. And I'm leaving these photos of my children here to be friends for Phoenix. And I think that I came to the cemetery not to find Bruce Lee's grave in the end, but actually to find Phoenix's. And so that was the moment. It shifted how I felt, because what I realized in that moment was that the people who come to find Bruce Lee's grave are mourning in their own way, and that we actually have more common ground than we thought, that grief is really, really hard for people to engage with, and death is hard for people to engage with. And the people who come to pay tribute to Bruce Lee's grave aren't afraid to engage with it. They're here to honor somebody who's died, which is the same reason I'm at that cemetery, is to honor somebody who's died.
Well, I love that you found that empathy and that common ground, but could it also be that those Bruce Lee visitors are just looky-loos who don't feel much connection to Bruce Lee?
It's possible, but I will say, when I'm leaving the cemetery, the path I take drives me by Bruce Lee's grave, and I'll see these groups of people there, and they're really respectful, and they'll leave flowers and little tokens and all of these same kinds of things that I do and that my friends and I do. And I really think that it feels like it's love. I mean, love for a stranger or love for a celebrity who you didn't know is really different than love for somebody who you did, but it's still love, I think.
Did you ever find the person who left that note and those photos at your son's grave?
No, he signed his name, but I didn't, you know, there was no contact information. I didn't track him down.
That is amazing, that act, to me.
Yeah, I thought it was, it showed a lot of courage on his part, I think, to do that. And he connected, I think, as a parent with Phoenix. Phoenix's marker has an imprint of his hand on the top of it. And so it's identifiable as a child's grave. And then, of course, you know, the dates on it as well. I think he connected with that. There's a whole lot of children that are buried at Lakeview you know, as we said, it's a historic cemetery, and there's a lot of children there who were buried in the 1918 flu epidemic. And so a ritual that I actually do around every Mother's Day is I go and I bring a bucket and cleaning supplies, and I wash Phoenix's gravestone. You're supposed to do that about once a year to keep them in good shape. And then after that, I go around the cemetery and I wash the graves of as many other children as I can, whose families died years and years and years ago, and there's nobody left to take care of them anymore. And there was one that I remember scrubbing. I could tell it was a sculpture that I thought was of a child, but it was made out of marble. It had really been weathered. I couldn't quite tell what it was, but I went over there with my sponge and brush and, you know, bucket of soap, and I started scrubbing at it. And as I did, it became clear that it definitely was a child. And I got to the bottom where the inscription was, and I started scrubbing and scrubbing, and these words began to reveal themselves. And it said, "All the light and all the joy we buried with our darling boy." And it had to be 100 years old at least. And it just struck me that this grief is the same through time. And losing a child now doesn't hurt any more or less than it has at any point in history. And losing someone you love is a profound experience. And that whole cemetery, every single grave has a story behind it and people who are connected to it in a lot of different ways. And Bruce Lee, as you may know, is buried next to his son, Brandon, who is...
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. He died during an accident on set of shooting his movie, The Crow.
Yeah, he was an actor, too.
Yeah, he was an actor, too. And so you have father and son next to each other there. And so I think about that relationship that, you know, to the world, Bruce Lee was this superstar of martial arts and movies, but in the end, he's a parent, and he's buried next to his child. And in the end, that's who I will be, is a parent buried next to my child. And oddly, now I took my son, Gabriel, who's 9, he's almost 10, out one day. He was with me at Phoenix's grave, and I wanted to show him Bruce Lee's grave because in my head I was kind of thinking, someday he's going to be here.
He's going to hear this.
Yeah. He needs to know where it is. And I took him out there, and it was kind of late in the day, and it was really quiet, and there was nobody at Bruce and Brandon Lee's graves, and we just stood there and looked at them, and were struck by, strangely, the intimacy of this place that's so populated by visitors all of the time. You know, there's so many visitors out there at Bruce Lee's grave, but it's, again, at the end, it's a parent buried beside his child.
So, Linda, now when somebody with a camera comes to you as you're kneeling by Phoenix's grave and wants to know which way to Bruce Lee, what do you say?
I almost always tell him where. Almost always. I can't remember a time in recent memory that I haven't. I tell him it's just over the hill. Go back the way you came. You're close.
Linda Dahlstrom Anderson is an editor for the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Linda told us she changed her last name to Anderson after Phoenix died. She wanted people visiting her grave, to know that she and Phoenix belong together. This is KUOW Seattle. You know, Linda, the woman you just met, could easily just keep her grief to herself, but she decided to tell you about it. There is a new podcast all about death and loss and coming through trauma. It's called Terrible, Thanks for Asking. And you will meet the show's creator later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Earlier this hour, we told you the U.S. Attorney General is under fire for meeting with the Russian ambassador and maybe not being totally honest with Congress about that meeting. Well, that Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is going to hold a news conference at about 1 o'clock, and KUOW will carry it live. So you will hear that in about 15 minutes. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In Lake Stevens, in Snohomish County, a family is asking the FBI to investigate the death of their son. Last month, 18-year-old Ben Kada, an African-American Muslim, was discovered hanged
in the woods near his home. His death was initially classified as a suicide, but after pressure from his family, the medical examiner later changed the cause of death to undetermined, in part because the rope Ben Cato was hanged with was tied unusually high up in the tree. And Cato's parents say he did not have a history of depression. KUOW's Ruby DeLuna has been reporting on this story, and she told me about this young man.
Well, Ben Cato was described by his father as a happy, generous young man. He was 18 years old when he passed away. He had plans. He wanted to become a medical examiner. He was planning to graduate from high school, and in fact, he was already part of the Running Start program at Everett Community College. So his father described him as a happy young man.
And Ben died last month, but something happened before that, back in November. What happened?
That's right. So around Thanksgiving weekend, he was reported missing, and he was reported missing somewhere between 1 and 8 in the morning. He left without his car, without his phone, without his wallet. And so his father didn't believe that there was any reason for him to disappear just like that.
No history of depression, anxiety, any psychological breakdown at all, so ever. So he was a very young, happy young man.
And this week, Ben's family held a news conference with the Council on Islamic Relations, which are, some of our listeners might know as the group CARE. And what are the family and CARE asking for?
That's right. The family is asking the public with any information that might help the investigation to call the police or to reach out to the FBI. Arsalan Bukhari of CARE Washington is also asking the FBI to fully investigate the case because based on what they've learned, local investigation is lacking.
At least two persons reportedly who have knowledge or may have had knowledge about the young man's activities or where he may have been have not been questioned. And, you know, more than a month has passed since his passing. And so for that to happen and this much time to have lapsed causes us to wonder about whether this investigation was as comprehensive as it should have been. And that's why we want to, again, bring in the federal investigators to use their expertise and knowledge and human resources to conduct a thorough investigation and really make sure that no stone is left unturned.
And what does the FBI say so far?
Well, the FBI says it's reviewing the case, though a review doesn't necessarily mean it would lead to further investigation.
And Ruby, what happens next with this?
Well, the Lake Stevens police is still investigating the case. The detectives involved say it's a suicide, but they're waiting for lab results to come in before the investigation is concluded.
KUOW reporter Ruby DeLuna. Thank you, Ruby.
Thanks, Bill.
And you can learn more about this case and read the medical examiner's report at KUOW.org. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. The high cost of housing in the Seattle area might push you out to the edges of our urban boundaries, where you could find a new kind of problem. KUOW's Carolyn Adolph reports on the underground challenge of the old coal mining tunnel.
Abandoned coal tunnels run everywhere under Black Diamond, just like they run under Issaquah, Renton, Bellingham, and Newcastle on the east side. All part of our not-very-distant coal mining heritage.
The hole was not big enough to swallow the whole house.
This is Tim Walsh, Assistant State Geologist at Washington's Department of Natural Resources. He's talking about the time years ago when a hole opened up beneath a home off the Coal Creek Parkway in Newcastle.
The hole when it opened up was probably no more than 10 feet in diameter.
Damaging a corner of the house. Very expensive, but no lives lost. Evidence of coal mines is everywhere around Black Diamond.
These are the coal cars that brought the coal out of the underground mine.
This is Bill Comble, manager at Palmer Coking Coal, which still operates in Black Diamond.
These implements were called joy loaders, and basically they were like crab claws, and then that's how these coal cars were loaded.
Comble says people should not be overly concerned about a coal tunnel collapsing and wrecking their house.
Most collapse happens in the first couple years after abandonment. So we're now in year 90.
But it's hard to get specific information. The state keeps a database of old mining maps. Black Diamond puts out an information sheet telling people to take a look. Andy Williamson is director of community development in Black Diamond. He says people who build or renovate in a known risk zone must find out the actual risk on their property.
They need to go out and hire a geologist, and then they survey the land and they give us the report so it's on the record.
But people like Judy Baxley bought a house that was already there. She says no one told her when she bought her house.
We were going to live here till the day we die.
She found out by accident at a social event.
If you'd known, would you have bought?
No. It's ridiculous. I mean, who wants to take a chance?
But now that she's there, Baxley says she plans to live with it. It's been decades since the state has recorded any real danger from an abandoned coal tunnel around Black Diamond. Assistant State Geologist Tim Walsh says the last time was in the 1980s.
A tunnel that was under the Green River Gorge Road burst. It could have been serious.
But everyone was fine. A woman driving with children saw a puddle in a new place. She stopped the car.
That was just before the edge of the road failed and water sort of explosively came out of the mine across the road.
Walsh says coal mine tunnels tend to be too small to consume an entire house, meaning there's probably greater danger from our region's natural threats, like earthquakes, mudslides, and volcanic mudflows. In Black Diamond, I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team is spending a month in Black Diamond because it is such a sharp example of the way this region's fast growth is playing out. Black Diamond is this small town in South King County where a developer called Yarrow Bay is building 6,000 homes. For a town that size, this is what they call a game changer. We got a sense of how controversial this development is when we saw a photo in a local paper. It was at a Black Diamond City Council meeting. The mayor was wrestling with a city council member for control of the gavel. We thought, what is going on here? Reporter Dennis Box has spent years asking that same question. He's covered the Black Diamond development story since 2009. I asked him, how did things get so contentious?
Well, you know, people at times, a certain portion of the people really feel kind of powerless. And I think that's part of it. And so there's a great deal of contention over this because this project is what they call vested now. It's going forward.
Yeah.
You're not going to stop this project. And
it's going to transform the Black Diamond area.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have a town right now of what, roughly 1,500 homes, 4,000 or 5,000 people, about 5,000 I think now. You're adding 6,000 homes and about 1,500 roughly people. So the big story, what this really, you know, you have to look at the genesis, I think, of this story. And that is the beginning of the Growth Management Act, which, you know, to say it quickly, things changed radically in this state after the spotted owl, the timber industry, you know, atrophied.
And spotted owl was this endangered species getting protected, meaning less logging, and the timber industry declining.
The logging industry, as it atrophied, land became available in these areas. And the Growth Management Act was an act that came out because the governor at the time, Booth Gardner, and other officials felt that growth was absolutely chaotic. And they wanted an overall plan to say, look, you know, we want the state and the communities to have a plan for growth so it's not just chaotic. And that's where the Growth Management Act came from, which was in the early 90s. I think it was finally passed in 1992. This land in Black Diamond was a tree farm, you know, a Plum Creek tree farm, and it was owned by Plum Creek. And so the deal was that between Yarrow Bay, Plum Creek and King County, they worked out a deal that was consummated in about 2005, and it was a transfer of development rights that was part of the deal, which was land was protected. The Ravensdale Ridge was protected, and then they were allowed to develop that land, which was adjoining Black Diamond, and a part of it was in an unincorporated. It's about 1,500 acres. And that originally, the officials that were in power at the time that approved this and put it through, and they think it's a good idea, because they felt that their view was that Black Diamond was basically dying, you know, because it was an old mining town. And there are a lot of little old mining towns around there that are doing exactly that. But I think the controversy really was over, and I think it finally ended up, the ones that are really, you know, centered on it ended up over two things: the traffic, of course, and the other is that, you know, they wanted smaller growth, they wanted fewer. Well, you know, you have, 1,500 acres, you don't put seven houses on it, you know. So that's kind of the push and the pull. And each side truly has valid points. There are no evil people in this. There's no caricatures. These are real people with legitimate concerns. But
sometimes it seems like some of them think the others are evil in this little story.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, that always happens. I mean, you demonize the other side. You know, that's the fun part of it. You know, you get to demonize the other side. But
that's the fun part.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's where the real, you know, conflict starts, is when they do that. You know, our job as reporters and as writers is to go beyond that. Our job is to make sure that we don't fall into that trap of demonizing either side, and just, you know, try to report it. And it gets hard because, yeah, you have people fighting at the council meetings. But I'll tell you the truth, I've covered city councils, you know, for years and years and years. And even though this looks terrible, it's not as bad as people as it looks. You know, this is what happens, and this community needs to do this. They need to fight this out and figure it out. And it's hard and it hurts. There's friendships that are ended. People's feelings are hurt. It does hurt. But it should be hard. People need to really take this serious. I don't criticize anybody in Black Diamond, either, you know, the Yarrow Bay folks or the Black Diamond folks.
You've started writing a book about development in Western Washington, including this story of Black Diamond. Why?
I guess I like boring subjects. I don't know. It's interesting to me. It's something that goes to the very core of who we are. The Black Diamond story alone tells us everything about ourselves. One side is a developer with a vision to make a town. He has this vision. It's a remarkable vision of creating this town. But on the other hand, you have a story of people living their lives, you know, in a place that they expected to stay one way, and suddenly it's not staying that way. And it's happening. It's not just happening in Black Diamond. It's happening in Black Diamond on a very large scale, but you see it in all the small towns. There's struggles in all the small towns. The advantage of a master plan development, which is what this is that you have one whole project. And so the officials can do what they call mitigate for that. That's the theory behind it, is, okay, you've got 6,000 people, you've got to do something for roads, you've got to have schools, you've got to have parks, and you're going to have so that you can tell the developer he's got to do all those things and have that in there. The disadvantage is what you're seeing, that you're taking a town of 5,000 people and turning it into one of the largest cities in the area. And that's hard. And that is and that's why I think, you know, the book is it is interesting in terms of what I call long form journalism, because you're talking about an argument, you're talking about feelings and legitimate concerns and fights over how we live every day. You're born, you got to live somewhere, you got to get a house. Something, you know, you got to get a car. You're going to have kids and you want them to have a park. Or you want them to have a nice school to go. All of that, that's part of all of it. It's daily living. It's what we do. And it's, I think as writers, it's really important to realize these aren't bad people. We're not talking about bad people. We're not talking about people that are, you know, corrupt or anything like that. That is not the story. The story is people just like me, you know, trying to figure out what they want to do in a community. And people that get on the council and people that get involved in this, these people are trying to do something that they think is right. Both sides are, whether, you know, the what they call the majority on the city council right now, you know, Brian Weber and Pat Pepper and Erica Morgan, and then the opposition is Janie Edelman and Tammy Deedy, and then the mayor, of course, Carol Benson. These are not bad people. They have different ideas that get emotional. You know, families get emotional sometimes. It happens. But they are trying to do what they think will help their community. And in the end, after all of this fighting, it will. It will help this community.
Sound Publishing regional editor Dennis Box. Dennis, thank you for this.
Thank you.
KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team is spending a month in Black Diamond watching this region's growth play out. If you've got a story idea for us, go to KUOW.org. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is about to hold a news conference. He's taking heat for meeting with the Russian ambassador and possibly being less than candid about it, under oath. We talked about it earlier this hour. We're going to bring this news conference to you live. It should start any minute, so please stay tuned to KUOW Seattle.